When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. And for some reason, I feel the need to flag up that it's quite a specialised subject that we're featuring this week, which is actually always the case. Each time we find a lens through which to look at London, it very often reveals a very particular dimension of life in the city. Maybe I'm slightly self-conscious because it's very much on home territory. For me, we're looking at T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, how it maps onto London, how London and the early 20th century mapped onto the mind of the poet. It's a slightly longer episode than usual. I figured that if this is your cup of tea, then, well, there's no harm in indulging. The other thing to say is that an entirely optional upgrade to your listening experience would be to read the poem The Wasteland before we go a step further. It's 433 lines long. What's that, about 20 minutes of reading time? It'll set you up for what we're talking about. Oh, and it's one of the most amazing pieces of literature the world's produced. There's that.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, step out of me. See a piece of air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam rack store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
Well, hello, hello. I've got a serious case of déjà vu going on here. Just a few weeks ago, I was on almost this very spot in the shadow cast by the monument, getting ready to talk about the monument. But this time, I'm with Tina Baxter. Hi.
Hello.
And we're not going to be talking about, well, not directly, we're not going to be talking about the monument at all. We're heading off from here.
We're going to use the monument as basically a symbol for the beginning of a walk about The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot.
You're well known, of course, among Londoners and visitors to London for The Wasteland. And I suppose we need to set this up really from basics. What is The Wasteland?
Right. Thomas Stearns Eliot, born in America.
Stearns? I didn't know that.
Yes, that's his middle name. Was born in 1888 and died in 1965. He was a very sickly lad, and that gave him lots of opportunity to read amazing literature, lots and lots of books. He then went on to Harvard, where again he seems to have read an awful lot of medieval literature. He studied Greek and Latin and read all the texts, or many texts in those languages.
Sanskrit,
Pali. He also read French literature and German literature. So an extraordinarily well-read young man, and was going to be on the road to becoming a philosopher, more than likely being a professor at Harvard. However, he decided he'd come to Europe, and he arrived in Europe in 1914. He met Vivian Haywood, 2015. They got married. And to quote, this produced the frame of mind out of which The Wasteland was formed, which you may gather from that was that the marriage did not bode well from the very, very beginning.
Turning up in Europe in 1914 is not a particularly smart move.
No, it wasn't a particularly smart move. In fact, he did actually go to Paris first, and then because of the situation decided London might be safer, and also he had various other American friends here as well. Unfortunately, he and Vivian, although they were very passionate about one another, they were, I think, more drawn to one another about literature and the poet, and she was quite determined to keep him here. She wanted the poet, not the philosopher. But he also had many people working for him, if you like, to promote him. T.S. Eliot had already had published The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. I believe that was in 1917. But The Wasteland appeared, first of all, in literary magazines. Firstly, that was in 1922 in The Dial in the US and The Criterion in London. And then he was published by the Hogarth Press. That's the Woolf's, Virginia Woolf, and her husband's press in 1923. And because he felt it was a slightly flimsy book, that he would include the notes.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, because, of course, the thing about The Wasteland is that it's really inaccessible, and deliberately so. He's calling on all sorts of literary illusion, isn't he, that only somebody probably who's read to the extent that he has is going to pick up on all this stuff. What help were the notes?
Well, the notes were really just a filler, and everyone thought that T.S. Eliot was pulling a bit of a fast one or having a bit of a joke, or did Ezra Pound put him up to it? It was not normal to the medium to actually include the notes, but Eliot felt that his readers, the type of readers he was hoping would read his poem, were really, really much more involved about how they felt about the poem rather than comprehend it. But out of the notes, of course, came a complete... just a critique on the notes alone. You can actually not even bother to read the poem if you don't want to, because there is so much, it seems there is so much written about the notes on their own. They basically stand alone.
And I suppose if we were going to do what he... Well, now, what's he done? He's conveyed a national mood or an international mood in his poem using ideas of fracturedness and so forth. So if we were going to replicate that within the podcast, we would need to make sure it's unclear which of us is speaking at any given point. Do some of it in German, Latin, a bit in French here and there.
Absolutely.
Finish in
yes.
Sanskrit.
Yes, I do have the last paragraph, which I think has at least four or five languages in it. And yes, it is very fractured. And the walk that I do is also fractured, because to actually create a walk with the same chapter headings in the order of the poem would be virtually impossible. So it actually works very neatly for me too, the fragmentation, which of course, fragmentation basically goes to the epitaph, which is about the Sibyls, the prophetic ladies who throw leaves out onto the ground with words on, which basically don't give you any clue really what's going on. They're all riddles, and you really have to make up your own mind. And I think that is really very much what the poem is about. Again, it's function over form, because he felt that you, the reader, should comprehend it in your own way. You shouldn't really use the notes at all.
There was a lot of that going on at the time, of course, with Joyce and what have you. You reminded me in what you're saying that we are physically located here in the capital, and there is a textual reason for us being here, of course.
There is a literary reason for us being here right now, mainly because of where the poem actually begins. We are standing by the monument, and if we look at the very top of the monument, there's a great big burning urn. Now, of course, the monument is in celebration, we might say, of the survival and the rising of the city again out of the flames. But what I'd like to say is the reason why I started here is because of the lines that open the fire sermon, and that is burning, 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 and it seems apt to start it here. And of course it comes from Buddha, or it might not be, of course, it comes from Buddha, but he would have known that this was a mantra used in the Buddhist teachings. And, of course, there's a lot of repetition in The Wasteland, meaning a freeing of attachment from the world. And he uses a lot of iteration. There's a lot of repetition. And, again, the poem is often called modernist. It's not a poem of the norm. In fact, it's an experimentation as well. There's no really one section or even one stanza that relates to the next one in terms of how it is actually written. Sometimes there's no punctuation. Sometimes we think, say things like tweet, tweet, tweet. There's utterances throughout, la, 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 way, way, way. He uses all of these things, and this must have been very, very odd to the reading public of the 1920s. And it's actually quite amazing how many people know a lot of it off by heart as well.
Well, let's get moving, shall we? Should we get some perambulation happening? We were thinking of heading down to St. Magnus the Martyr to get us started, which, of course, is at the old footings of London Bridge. Well, we've been there a few times.
People will obviously, if they come on the walk, they will be joining me in the church. But the other element which people don't realise is that Eliot was an American visiting London, and he used the Baedeker, if I've said that correctly, Baedeker. And in it, he marked St. Magnus the Martyr and St. Mary Woolnoth.
I don't know what this word is.
Well, it's actually, I believe it's an old-style tourist guide. Baedeker. Baedeker, it may be the way I'm saying it, but I think people might recognise it. People collect them, apparently. But he would have had one of these in his possession.
So what's this, like a pre-A to Z?
It is, yeah. Well, it's a travel guide for Americans in Europe. That's what I would call it. I don't think it was printed here. It may have been, but I'm not entirely sure. But his copy had these two churches, if not a few more, marked out. But these are the two churches that are mentioned in The Wasteland. And the other element of St. Magnus is that on the wall there is actually a memorial for a fire sermon, which again is interesting because this is something that he uses in the poem. Actually, section 3 is called the fire sermon. I think that relates to the Buddhist element, but also he would have been aware of this memorial. And I wondered if he thought how interesting it was that there was a connection in his mind between Buddha and this 1640 memorial to a great fire on London Bridge.
As you'll have heard, we've flowed downhill to Lower Thames Street. I remember in the poem something about white and gold Hellenic splendour or Ionic splendour.
The Ionic columns. Now, what happened there was we've got to remember the time we're talking about, of course, as well. We had just come out of a great war, and London was most probably not looking anywhere near as clean and tidy as it does today. And the buildings would have been rather dark and dirty, and it would have been very foggy. But it would seem that the new reverend of St. Magnus the Martyr had instigated refurbishment and redecoration of the church. Hence, the decoration within it was actually, it was really pristine. So it was really noticeable. It wasn't a dark, damp church. It was beautifully painted and decorated. And I would also suggest that it was most probably looking very high church.
Yeah, I've been in there not so long ago, and that's exactly how it felt, very splendid.
Very splendid, and lots of incense usually, even today. And we must also, I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that I need to do more exercise.
Yes, we've just ascended a Lloyds Bank-style spiral staircase. And we may need to take 10 minutes to recover.
That's okay. Eliot's family were...
Would you like this oxygen mask?
No, it's all right. I'm starting to breathe again now. Utilitarian. So therefore they did not believe in predestination or damnation.
Who are we talking about?
We're now talking about T.S. Eliot's family.
Ah.
And that was the religion he was brought up with. This obviously played on his mind, because eventually he did in fact get baptised into the Church of England in 1927, and he called himself an Anglican Catholic. So it's kind of a slightly interesting way of explaining how he felt. He most probably did enjoy the splendour of the church.
Yeah, I can't quite get my head around this, because the Wasteland seems to be about, one of its themes is the withdrawal of God from the public conscience, you know, the diminution of there being something for everybody to believe in. You know, everybody's belief was no doubt in tatters after what had just happened after the First World War. And it seems to be the fragmenting of belief, the fragmenting of a sort of a common understanding of what life is all about, that it takes for its theme. So for Eliot then to find God seems remarkable, particularly in so short a time frame.
I think with his studies and readings of other religions, who, I mean, I'm no expert on these, all the books that he read at all, but my feeling is that these other religions made him think, well, people believe in a life thereafter. So in a way, is there hope after death? And also he's often talking about dying. And also right through the poem, he's talking about the potential. There is a potential for hope, for rebirth. But in The Wasteland, you find time and time again, he just sort of takes it, he just kind of slightly slips it away from under you. There are a lot of examples. I mean, the Phoenician sailor with his pearls in his eyes. We've also got the Phoenician sailor in the tarot cards, and she never finds the card that will actually make the actual reading, make any sense of the reading. So each time he takes a little bit away from us. He never gives us the complete picture. And my view, my feeling is, and other people might have different ones, is that he's not telling you to stop hoping, but because of, I think, the very depressing time that they were in, is really, you know, you've got to be, I don't know, there isn't a lot of hope, but you've got to find it somewhere. You've got to find this rebirth. You've got to find it somewhere. But where you're going to find it, he's actually not got the answers. I hope that isn't too convoluted.
No, not at all.
He has no answers. There are no answers to that.
The poem is again representing in its form what he's thinking, so it defies understanding, but it's giving you the sense that there is an answer to it.
The great quote, that the one that people seem to like quite a lot, is "Unreal City. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge, so many. I had not thought death had undone so many." And he's actually looking, or has read Charles Baudelaire. The lines that summed up the most significance for him in Baudelaire's work was "crowded city, city full of dreams, where in broad daylight the spectre stops the passerby." And they were very similar in their themes: sex, death, metamorphosis, depression, urban corruption, lost innocence. But that particular piece for me, if you think about it, if you ever look at photographs of 1920s London, of course the photographs are generally black and white. It's very grey, it's very dark. And you could almost think of these people as ghostly, as souls, either the soul that they're living, but there's also the souls of the dead, which then, of course, follow them to and fro from work. Quite a really dark picture. But London Bridge was very important to him, as I think the River Thames in the poem. He was born in St. Louis next to a great river, and I would imagine that the Thames would have drawn him as well. And he talks about water an awful lot as well.
It's a very watery poem, yeah.
Very watery poem about mermen and fishmen, and he also, you know, he refers to the most pleasant of deaths might be by drowning. I mean, how or where he got that idea from, I'm not quite sure, but he does bring that into it as well.
Just on the subject of the river, we found ourselves on quite a big balcony outside what seems to be an office building, I guess, I'm not sure.
Yes, it's Clarkson's old headquarters, and basically we're on a great public space, I may add, which joins one of the pedways that actually comes from Pudding Lane.
A pedway,
yes. This is one of those.
Path.
Well, it's actually a pedway. The City of London created these streets in the sky. I'm sure you've heard about them before. In fact, it might be a good podcast for you as well.
A pedcast,
even, yes.
I can't help noticing, for a public place, we are literally the only people here.
Yes, it's one of the best-kept secrets up until today.
Where does this go? So we're we've got this wide open space. It looks very 90s to me, although it also looks damaged and neglected.
It's actually a Seafoot building, and I think they're not going to knock it down. They're going to refurbish it, and we are hoping that this public space will remain. And you can get, what you do is you come up the stairs on Thames Street, and we're now going to go down the stairs again to get onto the Thames path.
Smashing view. I certainly recommend this if you want to take a gander at the Shard and all the glass structures on the blocks surrounding it. And this would be a good place as well. I can never remember the name of the thing. It's the Coat and Badge, isn't it? Not the, I always wanted to call it the Doggett Egg and Spoon. That thing.
Well, the Doggett Coat and Badge, the wonderful ancient rowing race between the young men of that great old establishment. But I think it's been and gone this year.
Yes.
I have to confess I've not seen it, but it's on my diary. But I am herding sheep over London Bridge.
Are you really?
Yes.
Is this because you've been given the freedom of the city or because you've just decided?
You have to be a freeman of the city. So,
And sneaky.
Well, something like that. But
congratulations.
I don't know how much you'll see from here, but yes, I'll be there on that last weekend in September herding my sheep.
Fantastic. Have you been working out how you're going to herd the sheep? Have you been reading up on sheep?
I have. I've booked myself in for the 2 o'clock slot in the hope that they'll be tired.
Meanwhile, that's great, by the way. That's really exciting. Off to our left, towards Tower Bridge, we can see not just the Belfast, but another ship as well, which looks considerably more modern. What this is all about. Maybe we're being invaded. Maybe it started.
I don't think so.
And they're very bold, whoever they are.
It was funny, when I came over the bridge, I thought, I bet you asked me what it is, and I haven't actually got any idea. But
Why should you know? We're talking about wasteland.
I'm sure there's 50 guides out there who will know exactly what the U-27 is. In fact, I'm sure I can see a Union Jack flying. So have no fear, anybody. We are not being invaded.
Well, before I endorse that statement, I mean, this is going to go out in a few days' time. If by that point you can hear the march of jackboots in your street, then don't listen to Tina.
I think it's time now that we go and check out the Phoenician sailors, don't you?
Retreat, yes. I'm just going to get my white handkerchief out in case that comes in handy. Is it bad manners to surrender before any attack has been formally declared?
I don't know. I think you just might be... I don't know. I don't think there's any need to surrender at the moment.
I'd like to anyway.
You'd like to? Well, we'll get your hanky out and we'll wave at the boat just so that they know.
Wouldn't it be nice if a serving sailor got his hanky out and waved back?
That would be delightful.
Yeah, it would, yeah.
And we'd most probably collapse in hysterical laughter, yes.
We are going down another one of these spiral staircases. This is taking a beating, really. It does need refurbishment. And we are about to emerge out onto the... towpath?
Thames path.
Sorry, the Thames ped function?
No, this is the Thames path, but we have just been where you can actually...
What's wrong with the term pedway, isn't it?
No, pedway is... pedway was the terminology of those pavements, if you like, or streets in the sky, which were built in the 60s. There's not many left anymore, but I think it may be worthy of a podcast because there's people out there who actually do walks and talks about them.
If I was a tour guide who realised that a lot of the prime material had already been covered, I might make up a Sir Thomas Pedway, who was the originator of the Pedway.
Yes, you could do that if you like, but no.
Do you ever get tempted to just finesse a few details?
No, actually I don't, because I think what worries me is I hear so many other people out on the street who are taking people around and they're actually talking, well, quite honestly, an awful lot of rubbish. And it's a real worry, but I suppose maybe it's in my nature, I like to keep it present and correct, but I'm not always right, or sometimes I work on secondary sources, not primary sources, so occasionally you may get some information from somewhere where the date might be wrong or some of the background, so, and I'm always very happy to be corrected or to say to somebody, I'll check it out, but like we're doing today, we do make jokes about things and play on words and so on. The wasteland is great because really it's your interpretation, not just mine or the person who's coming on the walk. Oh dear, it looks like they're creating pens for the sheep, do you think?
These are your sheep.
Yeah.
I think this is for... This looks like for London Fashion Week, if it hasn't already.
Well, no, it doesn't. It looks like... if you could see this, listener, what we've got is turf being laid out.
Outside Billingsgate.
By the Ream. Little picket fences like you'd see on the British Bake Off, some marquees. This looks not like fashion, this looks like sheep.
I can see a sign in through the door saying... It looks like wow, and then it's got grass underneath it. Grass.
They're selling drugs.
I'm not. No, this is just turf. This is turf. Mm. This isn't the other. This isn't with no weed in it.
I better make that a question for legal reasons. Are they selling grass? No, they're not.
Very clever.
There's nothing improper going on here. Mm. It's got a bit of a sheepy smell, though, doesn't it?
It's definitely. It's not AstroTurf. It's the real thing. I think it's just going to be some huge corporate event, but it'd be interesting to guess what it is with all this abundance of grass.
Listen, anybody who's tuned in for the Wasteland is going to be sore disappointed at this moment. Should we swerve back?
We're going to just pause here for a moment.
Here, being on a little corner.
My stop here and what the relevance is basically the Customs House. This version of the Customs House was built in the, probably built in the late 18th century with 19th century refurbishment and additions. But this is the place where I like to talk about trade and business, or the trade-off, as I call it, and the business of sex in...
Sex?
Yes, sex in the Wasteland.
Because in the Wasteland.
In the Wasteland, not...
They built this whole thing for sex?
No. But the Customs House, for me, is a marker because... Elliot worked for Lloyd's in the Foreign and Colonial Department when it was in Lombard Street.
Yeah, and can I just jump on that?
Yeah.
Given his education, as we've established it so far, how on earth did he end up doing that?
He ended up doing that because his wife, Vivian, was always very sick and he always had huge medical bills to pay. So he really needed to have a day job. To pay the bills. And while, of course, he was working there, he was continuing to write his, as he calls it, his little poem, which became The Wasteland. But here I would talk about actually Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents at sight, asked me in demotic French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. So there we go, you see, mixing business with pleasure. But in fact, what all that is saying is Smyrna was actually a contemporary issue at the time. It's now the modern Izmir in Turkey, and it was to do with really partition, post-war settlement. And it would have made an impact on Lloyd's, Smyrna being given to the Greeks because it would damage the trade with Turkey. And apparently a Mr. Eugenides did turn up at Lloyd's and did proposition Mr. Elliot. So I think that's quite sweet. And then we've got, that's actually mentioned in part three, the fire sermon. And then I move swiftly on to another fragment, number four, part four, death by water. Phlebas the Phoenician. So hence, I like to be near the water so we get the feeling of this and maybe where some of his thoughts may have come from. And again, lots of water appears in the Wasteland. We've also got Elizabeth and Leicester are in a fantastic gilded shell, which could be the Gloriana that we have seen not so long ago. I then swiftly move on to the small house agent's clerk who makes an undesired assault on a very bored young woman. And then he often repeats, sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. And he refers again in these lines to nymphs, and I think he's talking about the sirens and the prophets, and talking about the young girls on the riverbank, cavorting with the heirs of city directors, departed and have left no addresses. So he's, in all that section, he's not only talking about his job, but also about lust, not love. And I think that may have been very much part of his original attraction to his wife. So really, that's where the customs house would be brought in.
Let me ask. I don't know if this is something you want to address or not, but Elliot and women.
Yes.
And to some extent, Elliot and Jewish people tend to be particularly hot-button topics as far as Elliot's concerned.
Well, I tend not to... Well, obviously, I do talk about women because there's a lot of women mentioned in it, whether historically or alluded to. I tend not to bring up... I don't tend to discuss his supposed writings being anti-Jewish. He does mention the seven-armed candelabra in one of his sections, which is basically to do with the interior of the temple at Jerusalem. Mainly that's to do with opulence. Women, he had ladies who thought they were going to marry him, or he had the loves of his life, which nothing really came about. And I tend not to dwell on Vivian's supposed, well, she was abandoned by him. I don't think you could really call it anything else. But he was not the one who committed her to the sanatorium. That was her family that actually did that. But he never actually divorced her. And I don't really know if he supported her very much in any way. But that could also be perhaps his Anglican Catholic element, that he felt as long as she lived that he would remain married to her. And then he went on to marry Valerie, his secretary. Vivian died, and he then married Valerie, his secretary. And he seemed to have, if I dare say it, lived happily ever after thereafter. And recently poems have come to light, very erotic and passionate poetry about their time together. So in one sense, I do end on, when we end the walk, I do bring that in. I don't deny that he treated Vivian not very kindly, but I like to leave on a high note to say that he in fact did find happiness, and his poetry thereafter, the erotic poetry, actually shows that he could write in a completely different way.
And it is, some of his writing really is very physical, very tender. When you look at a picture of the fellow, you wouldn't think it.
No, you wouldn't. And also when he reads it himself, he really seems to just read it in a monotone. And then when you hear Alec Guinness read it, or Fiona Shaw, who does an absolutely brilliant version, which brings alive all those monologue and dialogues and all that sort of sweeping elegance, and then that sort of almost misery as well, she really brings that to life. Shall we go to St Dunstan's in the East?
I'd love nothing better.
It may be a place that you haven't visited before, and your listeners might be interested in it.
Let's find out. Well, I mean, we're not going to find out if the listeners are interested.
No.
Right now. Let's live in hope. So we're off the Thames Ped Path. The Thames Ped Road. And we're walking down an alley ped between large brown brick wall and the large brown brick building.
We're just walking down the side of Billingsgate and heading towards... I never can quite get them right, whether we're at Lower or Upper Thames Street. It's... I haven't ever quite got my mind around that, but I do know where I'm going.
We're coming into a canyon of office buildings. So on balance... And maybe it's an unfair moment in the discussion to ask you, but do you like Elliot?
I think I actually hadn't realised that I was actually alive when he did his readings, or still did readings. I would have certainly gone to hear him. I'm not sure if I would have actually liked him I doubt if I'd have ever moved in his circles, but I think it would be difficult until you actually met him face to face, because there are also some interesting elements of his character which I would have liked to have experienced. Mm. And as we get towards the end of the walk, I will share that. I will share that with you. So we come from the roaring dual carriageway and cycle lanes into the quiet of St Dunstan, which is a ruin.
Oh, yes. I see what we're looking at. And if you misunderstand what that sign is hanging off, it looks like it's a Premier Inn as well.
Well, it has a very symbolic moon on it, which I think is quite nice. But we shall get that out of our sight line shortly.
There's one of the walls there with Gothic arches and lots of foliage overhanging. It's bordering on jungle. And then the clock tower. What an interesting name this bit of roadway has. It's Idol Lane, I-D-O-L, next to a church. Yes.
It's Idol Lane.
Idol Lane.
Which, in fact, on my last walk, somebody asked me, is that to do with idolatry? And I looked it up, and it's actually suggested that it was a street where idlers would hang out. Idle people, rather than idols.
Wrong spelling.
It's most probably a very ancient medieval way of spelling it.
Mm-hmm. Was that you finessing a fact by any chance?
No, seriously, I checked it. It could be idlers. It's, these street names have not changed over hundreds and hundreds of years, and you have to forgive their spelling. But here we are in the heart of what was St. Dunstan's in the East, which was, I'm afraid it's like most of Wren's churches. It was destroyed in the Great Fire, rebuilt by Sir Christopher Wren, and then, unfortunately, in World War II, got a direct hit, certainly on the nave of the church. And like several other churches in the city, it was left to be a beautiful garden for the enjoyment. But
it actually is a beautiful garden.
It is a very beautiful garden, and we'll just go in a little bit further.
A lot of tropical plants going on.
I use this site basically as my... what people might not be aware of is that the Wasteland, the actual title, comes from Mort d'Arthur, and written by Thomas Malory in 1417. But also in Mort d'Arthur is, of course, the quest for the Holy Grail, which when we were on looking at London Bridge and on the Pedway balcony, you were talking about, you know, this despair and lack of hope. And the Wasteland could be actually seen a similar quest as the Holy Grail. It's a philosophical, even a psychological quest for some answers. And he has used this being in the Wasteland, going through the Wasteland, this hopeless quest for the Holy Grail. And it comes up again in the tarot cards as well, with the lady holding the grail, but in front of her is water and the knight can't get to her. And, you know, is this just illusion? Are these just something that's going on in your head? But this place, for me, is three things. It's in the poem. It's the Chapel Perilous of the Holy Grail. It's the Garden of Gethsemane, which is also mentioned. And he also talks a lot about the decay of Eastern Europe, upheaval after World War I. And in fact, when I was last here, it was 32 degrees and very, very sunny. But today, when it's grey and dark, it actually has quite an eerie feeling. And in that same section, in number 5, What the Thunder Said, there is an extraordinary piece of writing which has no punctuation and considerable repetition at the beginning, at the end of lines. And it talks about water, whether the water is actually there or not. And here, of course, we have the trickling of a fountain too. So it really, really is atmospheric. And I will just, I won't read too much, but this is how it is on these grey days. And bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings and crawled head downward down a blackened wall. And upside down in air were towers tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted walls. And I just think that just fits so absolutely beautifully here. Yes, there's a lot of other things going on here. He had also read Shackleton's book or account of his adventures, if you like, in the Antarctic. And when he was writing, they were always talking about that there seems to be an extra person in their group. When they did a head count, there was always seemed to be the presence of someone else. this kind of sort of mirage of a person. And he also, in the poem, relates to the disciples on the road to Emmaus, where there is a third man with them who is unrecognized. And he's talking about, again, I think that goes back to our, scepters is the one, the scepter is the one you hold in your hand. If I miss a Mrs. Malaprop, I'm sorry.
Scepter is what you beat somebody to death with.
All right, fine. Good. And the scepter
is what they are afterwards.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fine, okay, thank you. That will help me a lot. I'm sorry if I've ruined the moment there. But that's why we stop here, and it really is very atmospheric, and I think it's most probably my favourite stop.
I could stop here for a while. It's very,
it's
very, very restful.
Very restful. It's absolutely beautiful.
I should explain the water feature at the centre of this is like a millstone with water burbling up from the middle. And it makes me realise just how it is that there's a restful quality to the wasteland, because in the midst of all that fragmentation and doom and lamentation, there's also a sort of a serenity, isn't there?
There are moments of, yes, great serenity, or certainly of great thoughtfulness, of, if you like, allowing yourself to let your mind drift and to go elsewhere.
And what better link for us to go elsewhere?
Yes, we shall go elsewhere, yes. And
I think I'm going elsewhere now.
Let's go and join the idlers in Idle Lane. I'm never considered idle. I'm never still, or I'm always up to something. But I'd like to draw your attention to Idle Lane. Again, one of those fabulous, bendy, windy little medieval streets that people miss. But I'm always fascinated by who has gone before us. And I'm sure Geoffrey Chaucer has most probably walked down here. I'm not sure if T.S. Eliot did, because he doesn't actually mention having visited the church. But the other reason why he was interested in churches is because the government had planned to demolish about 15 churches in the city. And St. Mary Walnoth and St. Magnus the Martyr were two of those churches. And he did actually write in one of the literary journals that, and I'm just going to paraphrase, that it would be an absolute shame to remove these ancient edifices which actually gave people so much peace and quiet and a place of contemplation after they had walked or were working within the blackened buildings of finance. So,
well, talking of which, we have just rounded the corner and we're looking up a little... I mean, I've never really seen it like this. I've never come at the walkie-talkie from this angle. We can see the cheese grater over the back there. And this thing is looming over us. We're under its looming side.
It almost feels like it's almost going to slightly sway over us. And of course, the other day it was quite funny because everyone was asking me, "Oh, is that the building that you cook a fried egg and that melt the Mercedes?"
That's right, you can fry a Ferrari.
Ferrari. And of course, now what we see is it has its actual shuttering, which it should have had in what do you call it? Brise soleil, soleil brise. It's some wonderful French term meaning Venetian blinds, I think.
If it was sideways, you could throw a steak on there.
Well, yes. Well, in fact, it wasn't on the building. It was actually the reflection from the glass of the building onto the pavement on Eastcheap that you could actually fry. Apparently, the barber's also his windows and his all the metal fixtures and fittings on the door began to bow and start to have a strange reaction. So they had decided not to use them. And then, of course, what they ended up doing was spending, apparently, twice, if not three times more money actually having them reinstated.
Now, I've forgotten this about walks with you. There's a tiny little alleyway here, and naturally enough, we're rabbiting off down it. 6-7 St. Marriott Hill. It says church entrance. And away we go. Now, to our left, there's a shoulder-height wall. We can see a little paved area there, and there's some benches that you could sit around and have your lunch. Nobody's doing that right now, though it's lunchtime. And we make a right-angled turn into what looks like a church.
St. Marriott Hill. It's known as the... it's known as the Fishmonger's Church because it was so close to Billingsgate. But, in fact, the wall that Quentin's just talked about is... in fact, where the raised churchyard would have been. Of course, now all the bodies left London a long, long time ago. They were removed by the Victorians and dispersed and buried elsewhere.
So if you're running out of space to bury people, make your graveyard higher.
Absolutely, and that's why in the end...
Shelving, effectively.
Which it is shelving, but then there was this problem of seepage, which became became just a huge health hazard. Now here it would be inappropriate to talk about tarot cards within the church itself, but I like to use this area because again it's off the beaten track, it's quieter, and we meet Madame Sesostris, who people may not be aware that it would make sense actually, he might be interested in the occult as well. And it was very, very fashionable in the 1920s to go to mediums and to get in touch with your loved ones or find out answers from, you know, Uncle Henry, where he'd left his fortune. And I find that quite interesting because of his actual religion that he was brought up in, which basically denied damnation or predestination or that there may be a life after, that Eliot was actually... T.S. Eliot was actually quite interested in it.
Yeah, but doesn't that make a lot of sense in a way? You know, you've just come through the war. Everybody's belief has been shaken up. None of the institutions work. And so everybody's casting around for something to believe in.
Absolutely. You
know, that belief didn't work. Let's try this.
And I think it's a lovely section. It's in the Burial of the Dead. And if people are having a hard time reading the poem, perhaps on their first meeting with it, they suddenly think, oh, this is quite interesting. This is actually like part of a play. And she's a famous clairvoyant and has a bad cold, the wisest woman in Europe. And this is one of, I have to say, a favourite line, with a wicked pack of cards. So this word wicked was in the language, in American English, certainly in the 1920s. It's not a word that is just, I understand the youth of today use the word wicked, meaning something great or fantastic. And that always tickles me pink, really.
Yeah, right, there it is, transitioning.
Yeah, exactly. Or it comes back, it's made a reappearance. And she talks about Phoenician sailors, Belladonna, the Lady of the Rocks, which is referring to the lady at Chapel Perilous with the Holy Grail. They talk about the one-eyed merchant, and I always thought, well, the merchant, Mr. Eugenides, he never mentioned he had only one eye. But, of course, what it is, it's very descriptive. It's talking about the card, which is actually in profile. So it means that it's actually a profile. It actually has nothing to do that he had actually lost an eye. But it's interesting that he then refers to the pearls that were the eyes of the Phoenician sailor. So, again, is it... talking about eyes and all-seeing. But then, of course, Madame Sesostris cannot give us any answers because, for one, she's missing a certain card. The Hanged Man. Because interestingly enough, The Hanged Man is not about death necessarily, but actually about rebirth and renewal. And it's missing from the pack. It's missing from her pack. So again, Eliot has not allowed us to have a complete, you know, a complete picture of this. We'll move on. We can actually walk through the church and out into Lovett Lane.
Not what I was expecting. Not, in fact, a large central nave, but a bit of a back room with a winding wooden stair, plaques on the walls dedicated to various people who've come and gone, cross marble flags, and we turn to our left and see really a very spacious worship area. Kind of functional, actually. I mean, some of the trimmings and trappings are extravagant, but the building itself is quite modest.
That's most probably because not only did this poor church also suffer in the Great Fire, but in 1988, there was a Great Fire in here, and some of the best examples of very old pews were all burnt down. Quite a lot of the reredos was saved, and they're currently raising money to recreate that. But it is now used as a truly functional space. They have lots of musical afternoons. They use it for exhibiting paintings. And I think they're actually quite reluctant to restore the ancient order of seating because, of course, what you have, you can actually get more people in. But it is a very, very fine church, and you'll notice it's very minimal stained glass, very much as Christopher Wren would have expected his churches to be kept, because he did not like stained glass windows.
He did not design them. Why not?
I'm not sure. I think maybe he would have found them a bit too fussy and fastidious, whereas he liked to have these beautiful balanced lines with his pillars and his domes and his...
Classical. And actually, we've taken a couple of steps in, and I was saying that it's quite plain, but actually, if you look up, there's all the art in here. It's
got some great detailing on the domes and the arches, and the word escapes me right now as well, but we've got some very fine columns. It's just, as always, with anything really to do with Wren, it's just beautifully designed.
Yeah, I think I'm revising my view, actually, as we... come further in and look behind us, we can see a piece of furniture that divides the entry hall from the main hall, and built into that is the most impressive set of organ pipes. Oh, and a royal crest here. It's been the carving here is just out of this world. We've got the crowned lion and the unicorn there. Still not quite happy with the name Mary at Hill, though. It seems like it's missing a word.
It's because it's on a hill, as you see when we leave.
I'd like them to change it to St. Mary on the Hill.
Well, it would have been the way they spoke in those days.
Would they?
Yes, they wouldn't have said St. Mary on the Hill. They would have said St. Mary at the Hill.
So, as in, I'll meet you at Pedway?
No, because Pedway is a very modern term. We wouldn't have been speaking like that. You know, so what we're going to do now is we're going to just take some back routes to get us towards King William Street, which features in T.S. Eliot. It's a hell of a street to guide on, so I normally take my group down to another, as you say, down another little winding street, St. Clement's Alley, and then we go on to St. Mary Woolnoth. So I'd like to suggest what we'll do is we'll aim for St. Mary Woolnoth, and we can talk about that church, which also appeared in that travel book that he had. He marked up the section. And also because he worked right next door.
What was the name of that guidebook that you were talking about as well?
Baedeker.
We need to find out more.
Well, I see. It may be Baedeker, but it's Baedeker.
Listener, if you know anything about this Baedeker business, can you get in touch? I'd like to find out more about that. Maybe we'll investigate a little bit further. By the way, just while we're acknowledging, a big thank you to those who've been in touch in respect of getting the History of the Cab Trade podcast up and running. It's happening. We're all systems go. I'll thank individuals on the show itself, but particular thanks to Liam, who got in touch and offered his services, and it's going to be happening in a week or two. Meanwhile, you mentioned that there was a street that was a swine for guiding. What makes a street difficult?
Well, what makes a street difficult, for guiding is, in fact, the noise, which I'm sure people, you will be picking that up now, how suddenly from the quiet of a very little-known churchyard or the interior of a very quiet church, you come out into the hub and bub of the city. If I wanted to guide on King William Street, one, there is not really any good place for us to stand and do the stop without being in the way of people going to and from lunch or from work.
Do you think they're going for lunch or work?
Work, one would hope. And also, we've got fire engines, we've normally got a helicopter, but this is a major junction. It comes, of course, directly from London Bridge down to King William Street. So we're going to go underground briefly. It's the easiest way to cross the road. And do notice these rather splendid old signs down the subway, which mention Gracechurch Street and King William Street.
They look kind of 30s, or something.
They look 30s to me, yes, with the typeface. But they're just so elegant.
Around the corner we go. Good thing about Bank / Monument Station is it's so big and sprawling that you can basically go anywhere in London by choosing the correct exit.
Choose the correct exit.
It's got a Heathrow exit, hasn't it?
I'm not sure.
I believe that's true.
Well, you can walk all the way to Heathrow.
Yes, I think so. They've got a travelator, you know.
I wouldn't like to do that, but I know it's a good way to get a lot of people across. So we're just going to head for King William Street. King William Street, really the pavement, if you say, you know, what is required really for guiding. I personally wouldn't like to have a group of 24 people gathered on here while I talked about this street sign. So I tend to take them to Clements Lane into yet another churchyard. We can just go and have a look. So we're at St. Clement's Church.
Well, I didn't catch any of that. She's off.
I'm off. We are just walking past St. Clement's.
Well, look at that.
Which, of course, is a very famous church because of the nursery rhyme, Oranges and Lemons.
There's a bit of controversy creeping in here.
Well, you can, but there's like about 20 versions of that. Thank goodness there's only one version of The Wasteland.
Thank goodness there's only one St. Clement's, otherwise it'll get very confusing.
It would. The amount of St. Boltoff's and St. Mary's that we have. But it's also currently used as an office for a charity.
Well, the bit I'm looking at now doesn't look anything like an office.
If you just come up the steps, if you're able.
Yes. What I can see is an extremely impressive gilt altarpiece. What's a four-parted triptych? It is a triptych.
It's basically, you'd call it, as far as I'm aware, you'd call it a reredos in a church. But it definitely is in a triptych form, and it looks like it's got some interesting saints, and I'm sure one of them will be St. Clement's. But as you can see, if you look in, it's very beautifully designed as an office. And I believe it's most probably the Amos Trust, which is emblazoned on the door. And I do believe services still continue here.
Was that Amos Trust was one of those men who was inspired by Sir Thomas Pedway, wasn't it?
I've never heard of Sir Thomas Pedway.
Well, you look him up.
But you may like to know about...
There'll be something on Wikipedia by the time we get back.
Obradovich, an eminent sermon man of letters, First Minister of Education. You see, you couldn't make that up, could you, really?
He lived in 1784, the city Obradovich, 1742 to 1811, eminent Serbian man of letters, First Minister of Education in Serbia.
I did look him up. He's a very, very highly educated chap. He never really got into any much trouble of any kind, but so it makes him slightly. There's not really an awful lot of stories to tell, but he's interesting.
I really feel like that should be the second line of everybody's biography.
What did they?
Headline, what they did. Second line, how much trouble they got into.
Yes, exactly. I mean, isn't that what people are interested in? All the smutty bits. And yes, we St. Clement's Court is where I normally lead my group, because as you can immediately hear, it's much quieter than King William's
and
Street.
It's a dodgy alleyway, so
it's
it has the Baxter
alleyway,
flourish.
With yet another churchyard at the end of it. So be careful going down the kerb. And we'll go on to St. Mary Walnoth. I'd like to just get to Queen Victoria Street, which is at Bank, because that's that side of T.S. Eliot's character that I'd like to share with you and the listeners. So I think you all might be slightly, maybe not amazed, but definitely amused.
Could we be amazed if we feel like
it? Well, you can be amazed if you want to.
I'm ready to be amazed.
You're ready? That's excellent. I like that.
Can I just ask you about that, actually? I think about this with other sort of performance-related things. Situations where you're hoping to wow somebody.
Yeah.
With a fact or a display of something. Is there an element of preparation that you use? Do you tend to sort of undersell things and let the things you're pointing at speak for themselves? Or do you big them up?
Well, it's interesting about wow factors, because when you think you have a wow factor, it's not always everybody else's wow factor, or they've all been there, done it and got the T-shirt. What is interesting is the way actually sometimes walks develop purely with the group that you're with. Like if you're with a small private group, there are all sorts of things that make them laugh, which actually you yourself would never have actually thought was funny, but they just see it or feel it from another perspective. Like you making jokes about the Pedways, you find that really amusing. But there was somebody actually created
that. Do you know how small
name.
I feel now?
You don't have to feel small, but I think, honestly, you think you can have a corking, cracking joke and it goes as flat as a pancake, and then you say something that you think is quite serious and everyone's, you know, kind of find it really quite amusing or unbelievable. So you create a walk, really, and just take it out and, you know, enjoy it with the group. And sometimes it can be quite serious, or other times people will find just be amused by certain elements of it. St. Mary Walnoth.
Oh, here we are. So we're around in the corner, curved wrought iron fencing and gates here, very impressive gold detail. And in we come into the...
And a lovely cafe.
Into, well, now this is a smart use for a church foyer. A proper Seattle-style coffee corner.
These ladies give many, many a refreshing cup of coffee to many guides as we retrace in and out and up and down the steps.
This sounds like a not-so-subtle angling for a cup of coffee.
No, not at all. One is guiding. We now have a gentleman playing a rather beautiful, I think it's a polka, isn't it? But it's a bit dark. But here is a famous mechanical clock.
We're looking at what amounts to a 6-foot block of glass, within which is a contraption, big cogs and gears.
Yes, which is the workings of a clock. And on it is actually written Unreal City. A large section of the wasteland.
So what is this? What's the significance of it?
Well, it is. It's the workings of a clock, and I have a feeling it's the workings of most probably the 1920s clock that used to sound the dull sound of nine, which would have been very pertinent to Eliot because, of course, he was just working across the road. Again, I will point that out to you when we go. But it's really lovely that this poem is actually commemorated here.
It's time.
Of course, this is a very famous church because of Wilberforce. Also, an Elizabethan playwright was buried here, which Eliot would have known about. His surname is Kyd, K-Y-D. And he wrote a play about a very murderous deed, in fact, two murderous deeds, and he brings that into the poem at the very, very end, the name of the character, Hieronymus. And, yes, we've got John Newton as well. So we know Eliot definitely spent time here, maybe. I'm not sure if he had a packed lunch, but he would have come here for a bit of a break from his Smyrna merchants and the various other people he had to deal with.
I don't know why it didn't occur to me, because it's been all around us as we've been walking. We haven't really commented on it, but we've been passing on all sides, city folk having late lunches and shoving bim and bap takeaway food into their faces.
Yep.
Of course, Eliot would have been mixed up with that crowd.
He would have. I mean, it may have been slightly different. I doubt if there'd been that much takeaway going on.
Less bim and bap, I suspect.
Less bim and bap, and I think the wife would have made you pack lunch, and there would have been lots and lots of... I mean, even when I arrived in London in the 70s, there were still hundreds of cafes offering you a three-course lunch for a pound, you know, and you'd have your... Yes, and they were all steamed up and everybody smoked. It was quite... it's kind of like, yeah, like an old movie, really, yeah.
Where are you from, then?
I'm originally from up north, but I travelled with my parents.
Watford?
No, much further
Milton Keynes?
Than that. No, Wigan. Wigan, as in Lancashire.
I'll have to look that up on a globe.
It's a bit too far out for you, I know that. But yes, there would have the places would have there been loads of little cafes, and no doubt there would have also at Lloyd's been a canteen, I would imagine, as well.
Just while we're passing it and talking about all points of the compass, East Ham.
I know nothing about East Ham.
It's an absolute delight, you know. You should definitely go.
All right, okay. I'll make the effort. Okay.
A bit of a non-sequitur, I realise that. I'm trying to redress a grievance. If it's you, you know who I'm talking about.
That's the sort of thing that can happen to a guide. The other interesting thing is when you have a little group of drunken gentlemen sitting on a bench and you're trying to give your little spot. You only ever do that once, because a lot of them are very bright and right up there, and also they've got a lot to say sometimes.
What did they say?
I can't remember now, but it was funny. In fact, I just couldn't continue anymore because just some of the comments they made.
No, tell me, were they participating in the giving of the information?
Well, actually can't even quite remember where it was, but they would also offer information about the history of the site as well.
Right.
Which was usually from a completely different place or even country. So, it was funny. It was funny. It really gave everyone a laugh, but I decided to abandon it and move on elsewhere. So now when I see gentlemen, these ladies and gentlemen enjoying themselves on the benches around with their tinnies or cannies or whatever they call them, I tend to give them a nod and move on.
Run.
Because they can't resist chirping in sometimes.
I would like to tie together the idea that we've just heard with that of somebody who was on the show a couple of weeks ago. You may remember John Day, who was talking about a school of art in which the idea was to superimpose a map of another city altogether on top of the London topography. What about a tour in which you point out the delights of another city altogether whilst touring London?
I think that would be really funny, actually. I think that would be really amusing.
We need to find the right... Because if you're not a finesser, well, then this isn't going to work for you.
You could kid everyone that the Shard was the Eiffel Tower, couldn't you, really? And you could also bring in a bit of Berlin and Prague. I mean, some of these buildings, I think you could suggest... Prague is a very beautiful city, but we also have some pretty good buildings, and you could show people the Royal Exchange as the Arc de Triomphe. I think it could work. And then we've got number one poultry, which you could use the arcades and pretend you're in Bologna.
And of course, it was where Chicken Run was filmed as well.
Yeah, well, all of those things. But
if you decide to go ahead with that idea, I'll take 15%. I think 5 for tip, maybe 7.5.
Well, I think a little bit more. I'll be charging per head for the tour, of course. But I just want to point out before we move on is that famous clock. And that building that is opposite in Lombard Street is where T.S. Eliot worked. He was there from 1917 to 1925 when he went on to work for Faber and Faber. And often in those days you would also work on a Saturday. So now we're going to just go off towards our last port of call, Queen Victoria Street. I also mentioned during the walk the relationship with Ezra Pound, who...
He was Elliot's editor, wasn't he?
Well, he was Elliot's friend, mentor and editor, and he always used a blue pen, a blue crayon or a blue pen, and it would seem that Elliot actually ended up with 33 pages, and finally, I believe The Wasteland was brought... well, knocked into shape with 19, and it seems was very influential in actually, it's often referred to as cinematic effects. Some of the writing, he cut down some of his perhaps more elegant prose, shortened it so it became far more either like a photograph or like a piece for the cinema. Also, of course, particularly the Elizabeth and Leicester section always reminds me of Sally Potter's Orlando, or should I say Virginia Woolf's book Orlando, which was made into a film by Sally Potter. The Wasteland, I don't know about you, but it actually conjures up pictures for me. It actually... and then the other...
Which is ironic, because I gather that Elliot... really didn't like cinema, apart from Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton.
Yes, he did like Buster Keaton, I understand. But he did love theatre, though. So he did love creating... obviously, we've got dialogue and monologue. That goes on throughout the poem. Yes, it's there all the time. Even, I think, dialogue with you, the reader. Even that's sort of how I feel. He's talking to you sometimes, or... he might be musing. But there's also, in terms of that, if you were saying about his relationship perhaps with his wife, there is a section where she talks about how bad her nerves are, and she's definitely speaking to herself, I think. Or as she says to him, you know, like, basically, are you listening to me? She goes, my nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you are thinking. Think. You know, this sounds to me sort of feels a bit like an aggrieved woman who her partner or her boyfriend is not paying attention. Again, I would normally go, we're at the top of Queen Victoria Street, and he mentions that as well in the fire sermon. And it's interesting, we've just left some music behind us. This music crept by me upon the waters and along the Strand up Queen Victoria Street. Oh, city, city, I can sometimes hear beside a public bar in Lower Thames Street the pleasant whining of a mandolin. He had taken up the mandolin, apparently. But it's interesting, there are no more public bars in Lower Thames Street. It's just basically a dual carriageway. And he brings the meaning of Strand and Queen Victoria Street. Queen Victoria Street was quite a new street at the time, whereas the Strand is ancient. The Strand was the ancient beach where the Anglo-Saxons had set up Londonwick. So he's constantly also referring back to the ancient city and the new city. But I'd like to end, really, on that little section, which I discovered while reading several of the books about him. That in his everyday life, he liked to mimic. He liked to mimic other people's speech. And that's where we get that wonderful section where we have... And I'll do my best. When Neil's husband got demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words, I said to her myself. Hurry up, please, it's time. Now Albert's coming back, make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you'd done with the money he gave you. To get yourself some teeth. He did, I was there. You have them all out, Lil, and get a nice set. He said, I swear I can't bear to look at you.
You can hear the Wigan coming through there.
Yeah, well, yeah. A bit of that. he loved mimicry, and a friend described him as a company of actors in one suit. And he found his own voice... by producing those of others.
Is there not something extremely scary about a man as learned as T.S. Eliot mimicking your voice?
I think where they lived in Crawford Mansions... No, three. I think it was three Kensington Court Garden and Crawford Mansions. They lived very close to a pub. So when they had the windows open in the hot summer evenings, they would hear...
T.S. Eliot hanging out the window.
Well, I certainly...
Mimicking.
I have visions of Vivian and Eliot sitting in chairs opposite the window and having a jolly good laugh. I mean, today, of course, this is not appropriate. And I'm not even sure it was appropriate then. But it gives me one little picture of them as having an absolute... Excuse me, having a really good laugh together.
Laughing at how common people speak.
Well, perhaps that was it. But but it's the conversation as well. I mean, you know, you've got to have all your... In those days, it was actually apparently quite fashionable to have all your teeth out and have a pair of dentures. This was the new thing, you know. And also, of course, remember, after a war, everyone was very lacking in calcium. And I think most people, once they'd had, the ladies particularly, when they'd had a few babies, they started losing their teeth. So I think it's really quite... We're actually just at the sort of penultimate end of the walk, as it would be if we were walking it. We actually end it at St. Augustine's Tower.
It did feel a lot like we were walking it.
Well, we were walking, doing the walk proper.
Oh, I see.
Doing it proper, yes. Doing the full Dixie, you know.
Have you thought about branding your walks, you know, in order to increase public awareness by getting everybody who's on the walk to walk in a particular way, like your own signature Tina Baxter walk?
Right. I believe that people already do that. They already actually do that.
What is the method of walking?
Well...
I'm thinking like John Cleese style.
Well... That could be very tiring over a long distance, don't you think?
What would you go for then? Sort of a bit of a bob as they shuffle along?
I think...
For the whole group to bob in unison?
Well, I think the other one is like a policeman, mm-hmm. Sort of the policeman bob. I think what would be more interesting is when you actually stop the group to actually get them to mimic whatever you were doing, a bit like follow the leader. You know,
or mimic some people who are talking in a nearby pub.
Well, absolutely, picking up on another conversation, especially phone conversations these days can be very interesting as you go past them. I think actually nowadays we do actually mimic people on the telephone, on the mobile. Excuse me, it's a bit old fashioned. You know, you hear people talking about their medical condition or their love affairs on the train, and you think sometimes you think, oh my God, I wish they'd stop. Or other times you just sit there and. Generally, I'm completely amused by...
Or slow down so you can write it.
Yes, or slow down, or can I record it? Or could you actually say your credit card number again so I can... Can I make a note of it, please?
I have heard somebody do that.
It is done. People do not realise how much information they give out. So, hence, living above a pub or very close to a pub... But it seems that he mimicked all sorts of people, and he most probably... That's why he liked Buster Keaton... Well, who's to say he didn't mimic him too? But I like people to think that there was a very amusing and chilled side of our Mr. Eliot, as well as a very, very serious, scholarly, academic man. And, you know, he went on to write some amazing plays. He won the Nobel Peace Prize. He got married and lived happily ever after with his beautiful secretary, who, after his death, looked after everything for him. So, took care of his work.
T.S. Eliot, polylinguist, lover, parrot.
Mimic. Yep.
Very impressive. Okay. You're talking about giving out information. I think it's high time we gave out some of yours.
Okay, fine. Starting with bank details. I can't remember them. I always have to write them down, so please don't rob me, because they're written in secret code in my address book. But anyway, what's happening is I will be doing a special walk on the 26th of September... for T.S. Eliot's birthday. Don't ask me which one. I think it could be his 99th birthday, because we actually know 98th birthday, because there'll be a big celebration in 2018. And also the walk can be booked at footprintsoflondon.com. So, and I'll also be doing the walks again, two of them in October, again on the same site, footprintsoflondon.com. For the Footprints Literary Festival.
Tina Baxter, thanks very much indeed.
My pleasure.
My heart aches for some far off place, no one cutters.
that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Tina Baxter. Thanks to Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.